This is Everything is Workable, a podcast where we examine how every experience, every situation, every moment is an opportunity to work with our mind. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of wisdom. In this season, I'm talking with other people about their approach to life and practice. Today's episode is with Emmanuel Plesch, who takes a secular approach to spirituality. He shares with me his journey through various spiritual communities and how he's come to recognize the importance of flexibility for any system of belief, and what it looks like to take what we study and apply it to how we live. He also talks about his experience with substance abuse and the role community support groups have had in his practice. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. Your support in getting this in front of an ever wider audience is hugely appreciated. And now, on to my conversation with Emmanuel. Thank you, first of all.
You bet.
For taking the time to do this. To start, I'd like to give the listeners an idea of how you and I connected. So we both use the Insight Meditation Timer, and we seem to be meditating at the same times a lot. And I can't remember exactly what it was. I think I noticed that you were based near me, and that was sort of the thing. But you noticed my podcast on there and started listening to it and then sending me feedback. And then we started texting and it was really awesome. And I actually was saying to my wife, this person is like my biggest fan right now. So you use the Insight Meditation app. So you meditate. To start off, could you just tell me a little bit about how you came to meditation?
I think I came to meditation probably about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, something like that, when I read The Buddha's Brain by Rick Hansen and somebody else. And I really liked the scientific approach to it. I was leaving religion and getting skeptical about things and thinking critically. And then here I got this Buddha's Brain book from some podcast or another that's talking about how this meditation stuff has some real scientifically provable background to it. So I started meditating some, and I got Insight Timer for doing that.
Just like a general review thing, how do you find the Insight Meditation app?
Oh, I love it. I think that, as a meditation timer, it's does a great job. You can set bells to go as often as you want. I have one preset saved where it does a wood block every second for 5 minutes, and then a bell, and then 5 minutes later a bell, and then a finishing bell. So that's for this thing called threefold mindfulness meditation. You know, so you can get really tricky with them, or you can just have it give you a bell when you're done.
Yeah, I do like how customizable it is. I just used it for when I was in a longer retreat, and it was great to set up regular intervals. So just to be able to basically turn it on and not have to check it, and it would go on regular intervals, which I broke up with walking meditation in my case. But I love that that's an aspect of it, is you can completely customize it depending on the practice, because there is a lot of different kinds of meditation out there, which I think people aren't necessarily aware of. And I guess that leads into my next question then, because you take a secular approach. I think you've already talked about how you left religion. Could you talk a little bit about that? Like, give your story. How were you defining yourself as within a context of religion to begin with? And then how have you moved towards a secular practice?
Yeah, so I grew up in this thing called Subud that was spelled S-U-B-U-D. My history of it will be rough and probably inaccurate. It was started by an Indonesian man who everybody called Bapak, which is like Indonesian for father or spiritual father or something like that. But he kind of had this revelatory experience. A big ball of light showed up and told him, this is how you connect with God. And then he started teaching people in Indonesia, and then people from, you know, Westerners started showing up, and then people took his teachings to the UK first and then over to the America. My parents got involved with it when it was still pretty young, and I grew up in that culture that was a little bit Indonesian, a little bit Muslim, because he was a Muslim Indonesian man. And the practice of that is called the Latihan, which just is Indonesian for exercise. So it's a Latihan Kejuan of Subud, which just means the spiritual practice of Subud was what we did. And the instruction went something like, you sit down for 10 or 15 minutes to get quiet, without really any instruction about how that worked, you know, just sit down and be quiet, which is, I've come to learn a lot, like a lot of different Zen teachings, you know, they just sit down, be quiet. Yeah. That's all. Right. And then you'd like surrender to God was the working of it. And you'd do it the first time you'd do it with other people, and then you'd be receiving the connection with God. And then after that, you'd call it opened, is what people would call it. So once you're opened, you could do Latihan wherever and however you like. But you know, I was a teenager, you know, I became a teenager in it. I started doing it as a teenager. And then as I had a kid and it was harder to go and do, and I felt alienated because these are the rigid practices of the people that I grew up with, and I moved away from it. So in my 20s, I was moving away from it and not really moving towards any other kind of spirituality or religion. And then my second wife, so I had a first wife, had a daughter with her, and then my second wife, after my first wife and I broke up, I married my high school sweetheart. And she got into pagan stuff, Wiccan, local Wiccan group called the Aquarian Tabernacle Church. And I started going to that. This is some cool people do some cool stuff. I play D&D. I like it for that reason, you know, a lot of dragons on people's shirts here. God and goddess, sure, whatever. And you know, I got into, presenting ritual with them because it was where I was. That's what I was doing. And then I got dissatisfied with that. I got alienated again with being told these are the one right way to do that. Mm. It's interesting because now, you know, I think about all this a lot differently than I did at the time, clearly. And now having just listening to Jack Kornfield's Bringing Home the Dharma, mm-hmm. he talks in there about how if you're rigid, people will become irritated. You know, if you're rigid in your instruction, people will become irritated with that. And I think, wow, it kind of seems like it explains at least some of my feelings around those different things and why I left them. So I got dissatisfied with being told what I was spiritually ready for or not ready for. I started listening to this podcast called Skeptoid. And on Skeptoid, he addresses common popular ideas like energy. What is energy?
Oh, yeah. What is energy? Yeah, right.
and so there's a lot of talk about energy, sending energy, receiving energy, this, mm-hmm. that, or the other in pagan stuff. And so as he talks about, you know, well, what's energy? Well, it's kinetic energy. We can talk about kinetic energy. We can talk about this energy or that energy. And they have real measurable things associated with them. You know, there's properties to facts. And so, you know, I just started as, you know, listened to more and more Skeptoid episodes. I got more and more like, well, maybe I just don't know. Maybe just not knowing is okay. You know, being comfortable not knowing. You know, one of the things he does in his episodes is he'll present the popular myth kind of a thing, like here's what people say about Bigfoot. And then now here's what actual evidence I can find relating to those things people say about Bigfoot, kind of an attitude to it. You know, things like cold reading and how psychics work and stuff like that. I just got more and more feeling less and less like religion. And then through that podcast, I started looking for other podcasts, and I found atheist stuff, and I got into atheism. But about the same time, I also had the Buddha's brain come up. And so one of the many different things I learned about was meditation. And then now here I am, I'm wearing a Buddhist t-shirt. I got my Rebel Saints Meditation Society. It's a group here in Seattle that I've been going to. It's hosted at the same place as Refuge Recovery, and that's based on Noah Levine's book. And the Rebel Saints is based on Dharma Punks.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, the Dharma Punks are cool and interesting.
Yeah.
It's another whole group.
Yeah. So I've found these people who are punks, and I listened to punk. I listened to California punk when I was a kid. I sure identify and understand those parts of, you know, just screaming along to Dead Kennedys. You know? So it's great to be amongst people who are just, I feel like, have a lot of common background to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Refuge Recovery, I smoked a lot of weed over the years,
mm-hmm.
and had been doing it pretty regularly. But I found that as I was meditating more and more often and trying to understand how to bring that present moment awareness into my day-to-day life and moment-to-moment life, as I was trying to do that, I'd just be aware more of how I was when I was high,
mm-hmm.
and I was selfish and unaware of what was going on. I'd be really unaware, especially of other people's emotions or needs, and just really, really stuck in my own head. So I started to feel like, well, this is less and less comfortable. So I started looking at recovery options around and found the Northwest Buddhist Recovery website that lists meetings of places like Refuge Recovery, and there's another one nearby called Sit Happens. It's a 12-step based recovery group that meets, and they just like meditate for a little bit, read a chapter from a book. You know, they've gone through a bunch of different books in the years they've been doing it, and then have a sharing session. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. So I guess there's a few things there that we could go into. The first thing that's sticking out in my head right now is just about how Buddhism adapts. And this seems to be a unique thing to Buddhism. I haven't encountered it in other religions, or I'm not aware of it in other religions, but it's recognized quite widely from people who practice Buddhism and from just looking at it historically, that wherever Buddhism goes, it doesn't necessarily push out what's already there. It sort of fits in around what's already there. So from the beginning, understanding that Buddhism was, like, the Buddha was a Hindu who reformed Hinduism with a practice that then became known as Buddhism. And then as Buddhism has spread, like, you get Zen Buddhism, which is very much from the combination of the beliefs and the spiritual practices in Japan when Buddhism reached Japan. And then the way that we have seen Buddhism adapted in the West. And for me, what I really see in that is what you're describing, where there is this ability to really join in a Buddhist community and find variation in Buddhist community that provides you with the kind of community that works best for you while still being quite Buddhist, and understanding. So from my point of view, my perspective and where my path has taken me, I identify very strongly with Tibetan Buddhism. And I do find a lot of the more what would be considered, I guess, religious practices of Buddhism to be very helpful. But overall, my feeling around Buddhism as a religion is that it kind of is secular. even in its religiosity, if you will. So could you speak a bit about your experience of searching for spiritual community with a secular context and what it is about Buddhism that has worked for you at this point in your life?
Yeah, I guess I agree that Buddhism, I think a lot of its core teachings are they're intended to be secular. And I read Stephen Batchelor, and read a friend of mine, actually, who knows me really well, gave me Buddhism Without Beliefs probably about the same time I was listening to the Buddha's Brain for the first time. And I didn't really get into it for a long time. You know, I just kind of put it on a shelf somewhere. But now I've read that, and I've read After Buddhism, and in there, Batchelor talks about how secular, you know, what's the meaning of secular? It's just the modern times. What it, you know, it's the current setting is kind of what the word secular is intended to mean, religious or not. Although, you know, we've come to take it to mean not religious. But that one way, at least, you can look at it. So I really think that since the Buddha was trying to teach us, my point of view, how to be in the moment, present time, awakeness, that his intention was for it to be a secular thing. And that people, you know, in the times of in the times and places where they've adopted those teachings, have made religions, you know, not judging it. It's just how it's happened that we've, you know, get together. We're social people. We get together. We like rituals. You know, I've been part of making new rituals. That was one of the things we do a lot. The pagan stuff, we were making stuff up and seeing how it worked. And then changing it when it didn't work quite the way we meant it to.
For me, that's a massive appeal that I have, like, for Buddhism. When I first came to it, was that one of those core teachings within Buddhism is not to take anything, like, not just to take it on because the Buddha said it or because Nagarjuna said it or whoever said it, like, to actually test it, to question it, to genuinely pick it apart, apply it to your life, and see if it works. And if it doesn't work, discard it. And if it does work, then use it. And that being like a core part of it then just really does lend itself to the adaptability. And like you said, the core teachings of it, and I found this wherever I have encountered Buddhism, is like the core teachings are the same, even if the religious trappings or the non-religious trappings are different.
Yeah, I think that it's kind of one of those things I've been thinking about, biases and how we have biases that, you know, most of the time are just completely unidentified. I think that I see in my life a thread of a bias against religion. Funny enough, started in the religion I was in, because Subud talked about not being a religion, but being a spiritual path and about a personal connection with God, kind of a thing, right? And so that put me on this attitude of, well, I don't like religions because this isn't a religion that we do. But then I think about things and I like that idea of testing them. And so I wonder, like, well, what about prostrations? Because I heard from you talking about prostrations, how you did prostrations.
Yeah.
And I think at the time I had an immediate, no, I wouldn't want to do that. You know, that's a religion. That's a religious thing. That's just a trapping that got added on. But then I also think about, you know, Jed Kornfield, he's talking about how their practice with IMS is to have teachers from all over come and to merge their teachings together, and about how there's all of these different paths to all of these different sort of like flavors of enlightenment, how, you know, one group might do it one way and another group another way. And just thinking about all of this ahead of time today, I thought, well, I really am an American Buddhist. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at all of these different practices and coming away with the parts that work for me on my path, and thinking about how much life has been spent trying to follow somebody else's path, and how much that leads to discontent and suffering, if you were to, you know, use an overused word.
but it's true, right? Like, that's the sort of, how much suffering do we cause ourselves because we think that we have to do it one way based on what we've been told? And how much suffering generally does that cause in the world? Like, well, a lot, actually. I can think of loads of examples of where being told that there is a way or a right way to do anything causes lots of problems, because really there's as many ways to do things as there are people on the planet. So I'm just, that really touches on discernment. So you've talked about bias, right? And having an awareness in yourself. And I get it. I wasn't raised in a particularly religious context. I was raised by an agnostic former Mormon father and I'll call my mom a Christian light. So I got to go to a United Church, and it was pretty tepid experience of religion. There was no sense of being forced to believe anything or being told I was wrong. I don't have anything like Catholic guilt. But I am gay and I am a woman and I am very aware of the persecution that has been carried out through lots of churches, and you hear it and it's hard to get away from. On the one hand, like, I understand why there's that rejection of religion, but on the other hand, I also see how it is incredibly valuable for some people. And I will see that in the way that they live, that it is something that they embody. It's not necessarily about what they're being told, but it is something that helps them to human better, basically. So really what you're talking about is your personal journey of trying to figure out how to human better without getting bogged down by the religious trappings, but at the same time, making sure you don't become a fundamentalist secularist, if you will. You know, there's atheist dogma out there. So what about secular dogma, that kind of thing? So what tools have you developed, or what things do you do to work with yourself to make sure that you're not getting into that place of rigidity?
Well, I've got this book I'm slowly working through called, I think it's the Thinker's Toolkit, that teaches critical thinking. You know, I'm not very far in the book, but I realized at some point, tools I use. I've been in therapy some. I have a lot of good deep conversations with my partner. I analyze my thinking patterns. The Thinker's Toolkit has helped me I look at these thoughts that I have. I look at these feelings I have, and I turn it around. I turn around whatever words they are, look at it from a different angle. And then I think just this thing that I've learned from sort of many different places has been to not believe my brain, my mind, really, right? Just knowing that, I guess it's, there's some part of it that's knowing and then some part of it that's doing and experiencing. I feel like it's really important to kind of point out for folks that just reading every book on Buddhism, on every different path, you know, on this teacher's way or that teacher's way, or how they all work together or separate, only gives you sort of, you know, gives you book learning, knowledge, kind of a learning. But it's not until I sat down to really practice and practice regularly and try to practice, bring the practice into my moment-to-moment life that I started seeing, being able to like see, what's this feeling now? Mm-hmm. What's this? Oh, okay. What did that come from? Oh, well, how do you know that that's even it? What if it's just a feeling in the body right now? It's just something, this feeling of tightness in my throat, it just showed up. If I spend all my time worrying about where it came from, then that's all I've done.
Yeah. You know?
And I found them really judgmental. That this idea that I had from, who knows, my early childhood of just hearing what I heard and all these other things, whatever it is, I'm judgmental of myself. And I think that the refuge recovery work has been really instrumental for me, mm-hmm. in just kind of being okay with it, accepting it.
Right. Can you think of a very specific time, like you sort of did when you're talking about your experience of smoking marijuana and then meditating and starting to see your mind? Can you think of any other examples of times, like when you started to notice something that you hadn't noticed before? Like you were talking about recognizing patterns. I'll give you time to think, because I know that's when you're like, hold on, right. I know that there are things.
So I was driving back home from a meeting over in Seattle, from one of the refuge recovery meetings. And I noticed the car in front of me doing that thing where you drift to the side and you hit the bumps and then you come back in the middle of the lane. And I had been just driving along thinking my thoughts. And I thought, oh, hey, let's just drive together here. And I eased off the gas a little bit and gave him space. And then I was just like, okay, I'm just going to drive along with you some. And I drove up to the point where, and he did it a few more times. He, driving along and he kind of weaves over and hits the bumps and then comes back. And then coming up to my exit, I pulled up beside him and I looked over. And the whole time I'm kind of just trying to be positive with myself, right? I'm like, okay, this is cool. We're here. I can accept whatever's going on. I'll pull up next to him and I just felt this rush as I saw that he was on his phone.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it was
Yeah, as
really
soon as you
clear.
said that's what he was doing, I was like, he's on his phone, because that is what people do when they're on their phone.
Yeah, and I looked at him and I felt this rush as I slam on the gat on the horn, just bom bom, and felt this like this rush and this sort of oh, I feel justice and vengeance, and I'm doing the right thing here, and I felt very much like I was just watching all of this happen and being okay with it and accepting of what I was doing, and because I was feeling really compassionate and peaceful with myself, I'd just been meditating for a while and sharing feelings and all this other good stuff. I just like waved at him. And for some reason he changed lanes over one and I got off the freeway and I just let it go. Like, okay, well, I hope you learned something. Maybe not, but what it is what it is.
Yeah.
So that was sort of just a time of being able to be there along with myself and be cool with the way I was feeling.
I like the way you describe watching yourself watch it. It's almost like you're watching a movie of your experience while having the experience.
Yeah, because I still felt really connected. I felt really connected with my whole body.
Yeah.
The whole experience was the movie, I guess.
Yeah, it is one of those things. I think this is when I really appreciate very skillful Buddhist teachers, because it's quite ineffable. And yeah, you can read about it a lot and you can hear about it a lot, but actually experiencing it is very different. And I think that's something that people just have to do. Like, you can't tell people. We can talk about what it's like, but you just have to do it one day. And everyone does at some point.
Yeah, and I think that there's clearly lots of different ways to get there, right? I mean, I just know the ways that I've done it and I've tried, and I kind of think they all pile up on each other and help each other along.
Yeah.
Mindfulness of the breath, doing that a lot, and then adding in mindfulness of the mind, kind of a practice, looking at, well, what was that thought? Where did that come from? What feeling is in the body when I'm having that thought?
Where is the
Those
feeling
kind
in
of
the
things.
body? That one's an interesting one for me. So how would you describe and define your practice now?
Without going and looking at my profile description on Insight Timer.
Yeah, none of that.
Yeah, none of that. No cheating. No cribbing.
Is it cheating if you wrote it in the first place?
Maybe because I'm somebody different now.
Well.
Yeah. My practice now, I usually sit 15 minutes in the morning. Usually, I don't every morning, but I'm part of this. One of the other things about Insight Timer for people that may not know is that there's groups on there. There's lots of communities, and I'm part of a 365 challenge, 365 day challenge on there that was, created especially this year for getting people to meditate every day. And so I've been checking out some of their different guided meditations that they're providing on there. So I'll either do one of those or sit for 15 minutes doing that threefold mindfulness meditation I described, where in the first 5 minutes you do structured breathing of 2 seconds in, 2 seconds holding, 10 seconds out, 2 seconds holding, and repeat that, which is a diving trick. It's a free dive trick.
Interesting.
To oxygenate your body. What you're actually doing is forcing out the carbon dioxide by exhaling longer than you inhale. And it's something that Noah Rochetta, who teaches secularbuddhism.com, getmindful.org, he's put that out there as a meditation to do. And so I'm like, all right, well, I'll try that. So a lot of days I do that. And then I kind of just try to check in a lot and forgive myself and accept myself and love myself. Give myself some variation of, I care about you. Sometimes pretty constantly, you know, driving somewhere, something like that. I've been really conscious of turning off the podcasts, turning off the audiobooks. Sometimes I'm conscious and I turn on the music and let there be music and just be with that experience of listening to some favorite music and being happy. Because I got quite studious for a while.
Yeah.
And life was kind of all about Buddhism for a little while. And, you know, all work and no play. But, you know, hearing about how life in monasteries, like life in Tibetan monasteries, is full of laughter and art and joking, that made me think again about just the quality of life I was putting myself in. And had a little retreat with the Rebel Saints, where we practiced loving kindness for the 4 hour, you know, set of loving kindness and metta for the 4 hours there. And that experience of walking, and I stayed in the room, but other people went out and walked through the streets and talked afterwards about that experience of just saying to themselves, I care about you. May I learn to care about you. And looking at people, you know, just people walking by on the street in Seattle. And what was it like to feel that? That got me to think, well, I'll just do that a little more often. And we'll see how that goes for a year. So I think my practice is just kind of trying to let life be my practice.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking at a possibility of some changes at work, and I'd notice such a huge difference in how, when I notice that I'm starting to get anxious and starting to worry about what's going in the future and all of that, and I can just bring myself back to what's going on right now in my body. What are my toes like? What's my breathing like?
Yeah.
Any combination of those things, just kind of letting my attention go a little bit into right now. Right now.
That's excellent. I think also one of those things that's very helpful to remember in times like these, without getting particularly specific. I've been talking with people about self-care and what that looks like when something needs to be done. And so you can look at it within a professional context, and especially when there's upheaval and change at work and or within a relationship, and now in this case as well, very politically. How have you found your practice is helping you within your role? Like, do you define yourself as an activist, or within your role of just being politically aware, how do you feel like this helps?
Yeah, I think that I am defining myself as an activist now, and my practice is just, it's kind of the thing that's making that possible. It's where I see fear and hurt coming up in my experience as I'm reading Facebook. You know, I've got a lot of political friends, a lot of active friends. We're getting the news constantly, you know, and there's so many things that I feel sometimes it's just like, oh, that makes me angry. And then I say, okay, well, what's underneath that? And then I find this thing that's hurt, and I have this feeling that's hurt, and, you know, wherever it is in my body or whatever. And, I put compassion towards it. And because of that whole idea that whatever is going on in my mind, it's just, it's something going on in my mind. You know, it's brought on by some outside input, but whatever it is, the hurt, the outrage, the fear, you know, fear for my safety, fear for my friend's safety. I've got friends who are blowing up over ACA because it feels as though half of the country is trying to kill them, literally. Like, that is how serious the impact is to these friends of mine. And I think about their hurt. And I think about my mom could end up on the street. She needs two people to assist her to get out of bed with, you know, with a machine. I think about those things and how they hurt, and then I apply compassion to myself because that hurt is in me. And then I think, what can I do? What can I do that's not greedy and not hurtful and is kind and compassionate, you know, and sort of those sort of apply those feelings to it. And so now I'm active with Indivisible. I went to a Democrats meeting last night for our local congressional state district, you know. And I'm just being there. I read Thich Nhat Hanh's 14 precepts of engaged Buddhism and thought about, well, how do I apply these things in myself?
Yeah.
Because I agree with you about reading, you know, reading the Buddhist things. The point isn't to just read them and memorize them. The point is to say, well, that thing there, how does that feel in me? This thing, how does that feel in me? So I'm trying to see how I can move things forward and not be polarizing. How can I move things forward and encourage people to be compassionate and kind and to say no to people's actions, say no to policies and actions while saying the person who's doing this is just another confused, hurt human being that thinks that this is the way that they'll feel better.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a fine point and a difficult one to recognize where that creating othering from any point of view is still creating othering and still therefore creating a separation and therefore more pain.
Yeah. And therefore helps fascism. So, you know, in a lot of ways, what I've been saying, you know, is how can I not help fascism? You know?
Yeah.
Which is pain and hurt and anger and all of these things being taken out in a reactive, outlashing kind of a way.
Yeah. No, that's really fantastic. I think that that's one of those points that is difficult for people to come to. And it helps immensely when people can share their experience of it, of saying, like, I can look at the anger and I can relate to it because I feel it too. And I can see where it can go when it escalates, and I can see what happens when I look underneath it and what I can find there. And I know which way is less harmful.
Yeah, I think that there was definitely some kind of leaps of faith that I took in getting there, you know, in accepting that we are all interconnected. You know, I've had religious experiences that told me that we are all interconnected. You know, I've had some really good feels around that. You know, I've to just come out of another closet, I've used psychedelic drugs like LSD and mushrooms, and there's those parts of the brain get woken up where you feel really interconnected with people, and in meditation I've felt those things too, and in Ladihan back when I used to do that I felt those things, and I feel like something there that's been really valuable learning from Buddhism is not clinging to that, at least acknowledging when I was clinging to that, you know, when I spent so much time trying to get back to one particular feeling, you know, one particular revelatory sort of a feeling of interconnectedness with all the people around me, that the clinging to that was what was keeping me from it.
Mm-hmm. It seems very counterintuitive, a lot of these things, like the idea of trying to relate to someone that you see as an enemy feels counterintuitive to protecting yourself. But then it is just asking those questions and looking at that. So it's like you think like, oh, I've felt this sense of interconnectedness, and so I'm going to strive for it, because it feels like you have to strive to get what you want, because that's what I've been told. But actually, you already are interconnected whether you strive for it or not. You just have to learn to relax into it, kind of thing, and training yourself to keep going there over and over again, where you're like, okay, I'm going to let go of wanting to be interconnected, because I am interconnected.
Yeah. And I'm just blind to it most of the time. Mm-hmm. And then if I can say, okay, well, I accept that. I forgive you. You're blind to it a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you're human. Why? It's just, I'm human.
Yeah. Yeah. That definitely. That's fantastic. So my final question is generally for you to give recommendations or signposts that you can offer. And I know that you have actually given quite a few throughout the show, things that you find that are beneficial or that have really helped you in your practice. But if you want to summarize them, I guess, or maybe just say what the most essential ones were or have been for you.
I feel like it's a really good idea to practice some mindfulness and some loving kindness, and maybe a whole lot more loving kindness than mindfulness, to just be able to let go of the judgment some, and to learn to accept the way you are now. I've noticed it comes up a lot in refuge recovery meetings, just that's where I've been. People have a feeling like, and I have this feeling too, where I feel like it's easy to send love and compassion to other people, to, you know, to that person who you love the most, or to that grandparent or to your cat. It's easy to send love and forgiveness to them. It's a little harder, but not impossible, to send it to people near you. It's a little harder, but not impossible, to send it to the whole world, you know, everybody. I can forgive everybody. But what about myself? And I've noticed that our mind, Mara, whatever it's called, has a tendency to think that it's in control, right? That we're in control, that I'm in control. So how can I forgive myself for all of these terrible things when everybody else is a flawed and imperfect human being? I can forgive them, but me, I was supposed to be in control of what was going on.
Yeah.
So how could I forgive myself? So forgive yourself, I guess, is my suggestion.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much.
You bet. I'm glad we did this.
Thank you for listening. And thank you again to Emmanuel for taking the time to talk with me. If you know of anyone who might be a good fit for Everything is Workable, please visit caitlinschatch.com, where you can suggest guests through the podcast link, as well as sign up to get my monthly wrap-up email, and you can leave a tip to help support the show. Thank you as well to Dexter Britton for composing the fantastic music accompanying this and the previous two seasons of Everything is Workable. Remember to please share this episode if you enjoyed it through any social media channels, or send it in an email to a friend who you think might benefit.